Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday the 22nd of May, these are our main stories. China is to introduce a new security law in Hong Kong, which activists fear is an attempt to limit freedoms and silence Beijing's opponents. President Trump says the US will pull out of a key international arms treaty unless Russia sticks to its terms. Reports from Moscow say the Chechen leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, who's accused of multiple human rights abuses, is in hospital with suspected COVID-19. Also in this podcast,
the two boys were spending the lockdown at the family's country house near Vendôme, south of Paris. One day, they decided to make a sort of outdoor hut and asked their father what they could use as materials.
So what did the children find in a rural attic in France? Find out later. For much of the last year, the sounds of often violent confrontations have echoed around the streets of Hong Kong. Night after night, people clashed with police over a new extradition law and concerns Beijing was trying to undermine human rights in the territory. They're likely to be getting out their banners again soon because China has announced that it will introduce a new national security law in Hong Kong that looks set to limit freedoms there. On Thursday, Zheng Yeshui, a spokesperson for the National People's Congress, justified a new law at a news conference in Beijing.
National security is the bedrock underpinning the stability of the country. Safeguarding national security serves the fundamental interests of all Chinese, our Hong Kong compatriots included.
Robin Brandt in Shanghai told me what the new law is likely to entail.
We don't know much detail at the moment, but it looks to be ambiguous and wide-ranging, which is fairly characteristic of some of the legislation which emerges from China's communist-led government. The South China Morning Post reports in the last few hours that it would take in moves against secession, terrorism, that word is crucial, and all seditious activity. More detail is going to emerge on Friday, the official first day of the delayed annual National People's Congress meeting in Beijing, and it could be proposed as a motion.
Robin, help clear something up for me. There are elected lawmakers in Hong Kong, and yet Beijing seems to think it can push this new law forward. How would that work?
Well, I mean, we could talk for that about weeks and weeks and months and months. You know, Hong Kong is a special administrative region. That is how Beijing classified it since it returned to mainland rule in 1997. It has extensive autonomy, particularly in its legal system, policing, its education system. It is a the very heart of the one country, two systems that was agreed between the UK and China when Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule. And it is that autonomy that some protesters believe is being eroded by Beijing. That's what brought them out onto the streets, sometimes in their millions over the past year. Promulgation is the key word here. And essentially, because of the way that Hong Kong's kind of mini-constitution known as the Basic Law is set up, Beijing has the ability to essentially add an annex to that Basic Law and force it through without the elected officials having their say.
Now, critics of this in Hong Kong would say that this erodes their rights far more than what they were protesting about before, the extradition law. What is the reaction to this?
Yes, I mean, already we're seeing some calls to gather on the streets of Hong Kong tonight. We're seeing some protests with, I understand, some riot police standing by and listening peacefully at the moment. But it is almost certain to bring about further protests. I mean, it is incendiary for two reasons, and that's the nature of which Beijing could just force it through. And secondly, it is just yet further evidence for some of those protesters. And look, they're not everyone in Hong Kong, but they are a sizable number. It's just yet further evidence of the erosion of their autonomy, a tightening grip they believe that Beijing is seeking to impose to change Hong Kong from a place that has this autonomy, has this kind of semi-independence, and essentially bring it further into the fold of mainland China, further into the fold of the communist-led government.
Robin Brandt in China. The Trump administration says it's withdrawing from a major arms control agreement. The State Department said it would give 6 months' notice on Friday, although it would consider if Russia, as it said, returned to full compliance. The Open Skies Treaty allows countries to send observer flights over each other's territory to check for preparations for military action. Jonathan Marcus reports.
President Trump is not just renouncing an arms control agreement that was seen as essential for transparency during the immediate post-Cold War years. He's also ditching a treaty that many experts believe still retains huge benefits for the United States. That this comes at a time when the whole structure of arms control is collapsing and a new era of great power competition beckons is doubly troubling. Mr. Trump, though, seems to be holding out at least a chance that the US could stick with open skies. But that's clearly going to depend upon talks with Moscow.
Jonathan Marcus. The Chechen leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, who's accused of multiple human rights abuses, is reported to be in hospital in Moscow with COVID-19. From the Russian capital, here's Steve Rosenberg.
According to several Russian news agency reports, the Chechen leader is currently in hospital in Moscow with suspected coronavirus. So far, there's been no confirmation from doctors or from Chechen officials. Ramzan Kadyrov is one of the most powerful and most feared men in Russia. For more than a decade, the Kremlin has relied on him to maintain order in Chechnya, the Russian Republic he's ruled like a personal fiefdom. Human rights groups have accused him of a string of abuses, including the forced disappearance of opponents, torture, and the persecution of homosexuals.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Medical aid workers in Yemen say a coronavirus catastrophe is unfolding in the southern city of Aden. The Médecins Sans Frontières organisation said at least 68 people have died this month in the city's only dedicated COVID-19 centre. MSF said that this was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the number of people who were sick and dying at home. Razia Iqbal heard more from Jean-Nicolas Beuth, the Yemen representative for the UN refugee agency, the UNHCR, in Sana'a.
80% of the Yemeni population depends on external aid for their daily survival. Yemen has faced 5 years of conflict. We still have people being displaced because their houses are being bombed or shelled. We have more than 3.6 million internally displaced who are living in makeshift tents. We also have 280,000 refugees, mainly from Somalia, who ended up trying to find safety in a country like Yemen. And now we are faced with coronavirus. So it's an extremely dire situation at a time where the international community has not provided us with enough funding to respond to all those critical humanitarian needs.
So what is the funding gap that you are asking for? What is it that you were expecting and that you're not getting?
So UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is asking for around $250 million for the whole year to support millions of IDPs and refugees in Yemen, so those internally displaced by the conflict. We have received 25% of that amount, and we are almost in June now, so halfway through the year, which means that half of our programs cannot deliver the life-saving intervention for those people, who therefore are left living in the open. We had a bad connection today with you because it was pouring rain, which means that families are left in the open, subject to the element, cannot protect themselves, cannot have access to water to wash their hands and protect themselves against the coronavirus. We will have to stop some of those programs in the coming days if we don't urgently receive additional funding.
And just update us on the situation regarding the coronavirus, because once that, presumably, if that hits Yemen very hard, that will be disastrous, as you were alluding to.
It will be disastrous because physical distancing in a country like Yemen is impossible. Families live together, those who have been displaced by the conflict gather under a plastic sheeting tent. People have difficulty having access to potable water or even running water. People do not have enough money to buy hygiene items or even soap. Half of the health facilities have been destroyed by the 5 years of the conflict.
That was Jean-Nicolas Beuz, the Yemen representative for the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has reported from Yemen many times. I asked her, how are the hospitals there dealing with the crisis?
Well, they're not coping. Just remember that before the entire world felt it was the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe, it was Yemen which had that unfortunate title after 5 years of war, a health system where some 50% of the hospitals and clinics have been destroyed in the war, and a country which is already reeling from all of the diseases that most of the world has forgot. So if you get ill in Yemen, if you get a fever, or is it that you have COVID-19, or do you have cholera, or do you have diphtheria, or do you have dengue, or do you have malaria, or are you severely malnourished, or do you have chikungunya? And there's been this alarming statement from Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. They operate the only facility for COVID-19 in the south of Yemen. And they're saying they just simply cannot cope, that the catastrophe is building, that people are arriving too late. They had 173 patients, 68 of them died. And they believe that most patients are dying at home, often in a very poor country like Yemen. We found when we were there for a few weeks earlier this year, they don't have the money to get a taxi to go to the hospitals. In the Aden, which is the largest city in the south, we've spoken to doctors who refuse to turn up for work. They don't have the protective equipment, the PPE. There have been protests there. And when they're in the hospital, they don't have the right equipment. So it's a complete disaster. And the busiest people of all in both the south and the north are the gravediggers.
And this is during a situation when there's some form of unilateral ceasefire in place. So it could get worse, I imagine.
Where do you begin in Yemen to talk about Yemen's plight? Yes, the Saudi Arabia, which is the main military power in this war, they're the ones which unleashed the military campaign a little more than 5 years ago. On April the 9th, they announced a unilateral ceasefire, which they've extended to the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which is the end of this week. But their bombing has continued. Fighting has continued between the Saudi-led coalition and the Houthis. But fighting also continues in the south between two rival groups vying for power. So when it comes to leadership, leaders on all sides are failing their people. In the north, which is where most of the major cities are, the Houthi authorities are refusing to state publicly the full scale of the COVID-19 disaster, which means that the United Nations cannot go to the WHO and ask for supplies. Only governments can do that. And so what you have is sniping on social media with the Houthi leadership blaming the United Nations for this growing storm.
That was Lise Doucette. Well, let's get an overview of the situation globally now, because the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 around the world has passed 5 million. The World Health Organization says there's still a long way to go before the coronavirus crisis is over, despite the number of new infections falling in some countries. Our global health correspondent, Naomi Grimley, has more details.
Health experts are worried that South America is the new hotspot for coronavirus, overtaking Europe and North America. In Brazil, where the president, Jair Bolsonaro, has mocked lockdown measures, they're seeing as many as 20,000 new cases a day. It's not the only country in the region struggling. Peru, Mexico and Chile have also seen a steady rise in the number of infections. In Peru, nursing organisations warned the healthcare system was close to collapse after cases tripled in the past 3 weeks. The United States still leads the way in terms of total number of cases. It's recorded 1.5 million cases and 93,000 deaths. But the daily number of new infections in the US does seem to be in decline, even in some of the worst hit areas such as Detroit. The World Health Organization has been warning this will be a long haul, particularly in Africa, where it estimates 250 million people could contract the virus in the next year. There's serious concern about low and middle income countries because of the indirect effect of the virus on jobs and food security.
Governments around the world have acted with urgency to this threat of the virus, often with a speed that seemed to give parliaments little time to scrutinise. It's led to questions over whether parliamentary democracy is still playing its part. and other virtual sittings taking place in many countries actually working? Keith Adams reports.
The eyes to the right, 202, the nose or dare.
Last year, Britain's Parliament was rowdy. This year,
getting the R down, not just in care homes, but across the country, is going to be absolutely critical to our...
It's empty and echoey.
The Prime Minister says that solving the problem in care homes is crucial, but that can only...
The atmosphere in the building behind me here in Parliament Square in London may be less theatrical, but is it still holding government to account? Some commentators have noted that Prime Minister Boris Johnson now seems more exposed to the surgical grilling from the opposition, unable to draw on the roaring approval of his party. Because as in other countries, parliamentary activity has been restricted due to the pandemic, with fewer sit-ins and members of parliament and more virtual sessions. In Hungary, Viktor Orbán's emergency laws have been criticised for giving him too much power. Timea Szabo of the opposition Dialogue for Hungary told me that parliament is sidelined but still sitting.
Every week I stand up in Parliament, I tell the governing parties that it's been now 7 weeks that Prime Minister Viktor Orban had not come, which is, I think, absolutely outrageous in this pandemic.
What do you say to people who say this is a crisis? It's understandable that you can't make every decision in the same way that you normally would.
The opposition parties such as mine... We're ready to give more power to the government for 3 months, for 6 months, for even 9 months. But he demanded to have this power for an unlimited period. And unfortunately, we were right because he is absolutely misusing this power and is passing laws that have nothing to do with the pandemic.
Viktor Orban denies the emergency law is a power grab and accuses opposition parties of spreading disinformation. Members of Parliament in South Africa last year fill in the chamber with song. Parliamentary committees there have now embraced virtual sit-ins. But the chief whip of the opposition, Natasha Mazzoni, told me the results were disappointing.
They are rather shambolic. Our chairpeople have not been trained adequately on the virtual platform dialogue. And we also have time restrictions.
So... the challenges that the virus is throwing up for Parliament, they are causing problems for accountability.
Absolutely. And at the moment, we are certainly not getting the explanation that we require. So it is our opinion that the government is evading accountability during this pandemic.
In Brazil, Congress has adopted an online platform on which laws can be discussed and voted. The leader of the opposition in the Chamber of Deputies, Alessandro Molon, told me that it had its drawbacks, but the benefits included giving more people access to politics.
In terms of how you can present your ideas and your points, it's a little bit more difficult. But anyway, we think it's a good change that can be used after we face the pandemic to open the legislative process for more people to participate.
That report by Keith Adams. Now, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Coronavirus has been forcing us to face some difficult problems, especially when it comes to food.
When on a Tuesday in March, all of a sudden the demand is like Christmas, your systems just can't cope.
While some have been greeted by empty supermarket shelves, others have faced a much starker choice.
In slum, people are just saying we'll continue going to work. It's better we die of corona than die of hunger.
On The Food Chain, the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, we find out how the virus and the lockdown have put our food systems under strain.
He got out of the truck and he prayed for me right there in the middle of a parking lot.
And we crisscross continents, discovering how the act of eating is helping strangers comfort, connect and convene.
Cooking is meditating, is an act of healing.
Join us to hear how the pandemic is reshaping our relationship with food. Just search for BBC Food Chain wherever you get your podcasts.
Almost 90 people are now known to have died in eastern India and Bangladesh in one of the most powerful cyclones to hit the region for years. Thousands of homes have been destroyed and millions of people are without power. Our Delhi correspondent, Yogita Limai, sent this report.
Disaster response teams have been sawing through trees uprooted by Cyclone Ampan, which have blocked access to coastal villages. Gusting winds and heavy rainfall also pulled down electricity poles and telephone lines. The full scale of the devastation is still being assessed, but thousands are believed to have lost their homes and belongings. Cyclone Ampan hit the coast and for hours it tore through the state of West Bengal. The region's chief minister, Mamata Banerjee, estimates it'll cost £10 billion to fix the damage and says humanitarian help is needed. The state's capital city, Kolkata, has been devastated by the cyclone, which many residents described as the worst storm they'd experienced. In Bangladesh too, there is massive destruction in districts near the country's border with India.
Yogita Limai in India. Getting passengers back in the air safely is crucial for airlines around the world and, of course, the tourism industry as a whole. Both have been hard hit by the virus lockdowns and the public fear of being in enclosed spaces with many strangers. The British carrier EasyJet says it's going to restart flights next month. Passengers, though, will have to wear face masks on board. On Thursday, Emirates Airline resumed commercial operations with a flight from Dubai to Melbourne. The chief executive of Dubai Airport, Paul Griffiths, outlined the safety measures in place.
We've already put stickers over the floor, rearranged the whole passenger flow to ensure that people can be appropriately distanced from each other. Temperature checks on arrival. If we have to operate a social distancing strategy for some time, that will have a big impact on the capacity because we'll have to restrict our facilities to be able to cope with the sort of distancing and quarantine requirements that air travel may require in the short term. But I think if we look to the longer term, we are very dependent really on the invention of a suitable treatment or a vaccine. I think we'll end up carrying some form of biometric footprint or signature with us to demonstrate that we are fit to travel. So that's the world I think we see in the future.
Checking that passengers are healthy to travel is another concern, and London's Heathrow Airport has just started a trial to monitor travellers' temperatures. Heathrow's chief executive is John Holland Kay.
We'll be conducting a trial as people come into the terminal so that we can detect whether they have a heightened temperature. And if they do have a heightened temperature, we can take them to one side and decide whether they would be allowed to fly or not. And this is a measure that is used in many countries around the world as part of a series of tests to make sure that people are safe when they are flying. So it's not been used at scale in the UK before. And this morning's test will help us to understand whether this could be part of a future common international standard to get people back flying safely again.
Plenty of difficulties there that lie ahead. Just how easy is it going to be to get people flying safely again? Well, Mike Johnson asked that question to Professor Joseph Allen, who's an expert from Harvard University on the risks of infectious diseases at airports and on planes.
Actually, I don't think it's going to be easy at all, and it's going to require a lot of coordination between the airports, airplanes, and the travelers. So there are some specific things that airports are going to have to do. And of course, people have a role to play. You know, airplanes can be vectors of disease. So it's one thing to keep people safe during the air travel experience. It's another to think about how airplanes facilitate the movement of people, some who may be sick, within a country and between countries.
Well, the airlines and the airports are already talking about measures like on the floors of airports to keep people apart. There's talk about running planes with the middle seats empty. Is that the kind of thing that will keep people safe?
Exactly, but it has to go beyond talking about it. Airports need to deploy all of these healthy building strategies that we would do in a home or office or any other building and deploy some of these strategies, including higher ventilation rates, better filtration. They're going to have to manage queues of people at security, in the jetway, at boarding, manage the bathroom exhaust system, and enhance cleaning and disinfection. Airplanes are going to have to take some of those strategies you mentioned, like skipping a space between seats, cleaning, disinfecting surfaces, choreographing how people get on the plane, and really importantly, making sure that the ventilation system is operating while the plane is at the gate. Very often, that's not the case. During cruise, the air quality is actually quite good on an airplane. Last, people have to do their job too. They have to stay home if they're sick. Everyone should be wearing a mask. Research on airplanes and infectious disease shows this can reduce risk by another factor of 10 if people wear masks. And they're going to have to follow the rules regarding physical distancing. If all of that happens, we can get to a place where we significantly reduce risk, and that can be the first step towards restarting air travel and the economy.
There is some commercial pushback on all of that, though, isn't there? This idea that I mentioned of leaving the middle seat empty for social distancing. The boss of the no-frills airline, Ryanair, has described that as idiotic. He says flying planes which are two-thirds full simply would not be economic.
Well, you know, he can say all he wants about when what people should want to do, and governments can decide all they want on when we reopen. But the reality is that decision's in the hands of the consumer. So the consumer decides here when we reopen. And if a consumer doesn't feel safe flying on a plane that's too overpacked, they're not going to come. We're going to continue this path where air travel's not going to get back. The right course of action here is a smart, safe, prudent approach that phases in these control strategies, starting with the most restrictive at first, and then, and only then, when you demonstrate that you can keep people safe, can you start to loosen these restrictions. So I strongly disagree with his statement.
I wonder if a lot of people are going to be listening to this and thinking, well, maybe I'm better off if it is a matter of deciding on, I should just holiday in my home country for now.
Well, everyone should ask themselves a couple questions before they decide to travel. First, is it necessary? Do you have to do it? The best option, the safest option from a public health standpoint, individual risk standpoint, is to not travel and stay home. Second, do you have any existing risk factors that put you at higher risk if you do catch this virus? Third, are you willing to do your part? It will be more frustrating. Things will be a bit slower at the airport and on airplanes. Are you willing to wear your mask? Are you willing to wash your hands frequently? Are you willing to keep distance from other people? And then wrap all of that in whatever your personal risk tolerance is. And I want to be really clear here that we need to view air travel as a privilege right now. If we all don't behave and act responsibly, and that means air travelers, airlines, and airports, we should expect that this is a privilege that will be revoked if it turns out that we don't manage this well and it leads to an increased risk of disease.
That was Professor Joseph Allen from Harvard University in Boston. The police watchdog in Britain has announced that it will not launch a criminal investigation into the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's dealings with an American businesswoman, Jennifer Arcuri, while he was Mayor of London. Daniel Sanford has the details.
The suggestion was that on more than one occasion, Boris Johnson, as Mayor of London, had used his position to reward Jennifer Arcuri with money and access to trade missions. The Independent Office for Police Conduct, the IOPC, said that after reviewing the evidence, it would not conduct a full criminal investigation, as it found that he had not used his influence to help Ms. Arcuri. However, it found that there may have been an intimate relationship between the two, and it would have been wise for Mr. Johnson to have declared this as a conflict of interest.
Daniel Sanford. Now, they say that every cloud has a silver lining, or in this case, gold. Two French boys, having to endure the boredom of confinement during the coronavirus pandemic, have made a happy discovery. Two gold bars lie forgotten in the family attic. Hugh Schofield has the story.
The two boys were spending the lockdown at the family's country house near Vendôme, south of Paris. One day they decided to make a sort of outdoor hut and asked their father what they could use as materials. He suggested some old sheets that had belonged to his late mother and which were now lying unused in a lumber room. Taking them out, the boys noticed they contained two heavy objects, which they initially left in the room, only later telling their father. He at first thought the two bits of metal were knife rests from an old-fashioned cutlery set, but on looking more closely, he saw the hallmarks. When lockdown ended, he took the objects to a local auctioneer, who happily pronounced them to be two gold ingots, 1 kilo each in weight and 50,000 euros, give or take, each in value. It turns out that the boy's grandmother had bought the ingots in 1967, but never told anyone. They're now to be sold at auction. The boy's last comment, according to the auctioneer, after he broke the news: "Now can we have that swimming pool, Dad?"
And a ride in their pocket money, no doubt. And that was Hugh Schofield in France. And that is all from us for now, but there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.